14 years?
We will start our 14th year on November 2nd.
14th year, November 2nd, and you are the founder of Present Age Ministries.
That's correct.
Just make sure I get it
all the details.
All right.
Yes.
I don't want to mess up. By the way, I follow you on Instagram and I saw you have a dog and he looks super cute. And yes. There's like a little illustrated book. Is that actually happening?
It is actually happening.
Oh my gosh.
It's part of a curriculum that we're creating for kindergarten through fifth graders on learning about establishing boundaries and healthy responses to unwanted touch. And if you use a cute dog, it really helps get the point across.
Yeah. Oh, that's such
we're
a good
really
idea.
Excited. Yeah.
Can I ask when it perhaps might be coming out?
Yeah, hopefully here in the next 30, 60 days.
Okay. Yeah. I want a copy.
Yes,
I want a copy
absolutely.
Of this book. I'll pay for it, too.
Of course. Yeah.
You said it's on unwanted touch.
Yeah. So it's
dealing with family members and stuff that the kids don't want to.
Yeah. And how do I respond? And if it's happened and, you know, just really helping lay a foundation of it's not your fault. And if these touches happened, that you get to choose and learning how to use their voices to provide, like learn how to find that important voice.
Yeah.
To communicate that.
No, I remember that even as a kid where, you know, and my parents meant all well, but they'd be like, oh, go hug your
right,
grandma.
You have to. There's like a force.
Yeah, and it's like, I don't want to do this and I'm not comfortable. Not that she was like a horrible bad person.
Yeah.
I just didn't like her very much. But that's why when I heard that, I was like, oh.
Yeah.
We're really excited. Very
and
good
to have
idea.
have a cute dog.
Yes.
Talk about, well, I don't like people touching my tail. But so we take
yeah.
it and it's in story form.
Well, it also teaches young children not to like tug on their dogs too. You know, there's also that
twofold.
Message as
twofold.
Well. Exactly. You can have two messages all of this. But I suppose we can kind of get started.
Yeah, we can get going.
You want me to kind of be like, oh, hi, hey, there you are. Welcome to Resident Skeptics. Was that?
It's a little overdone, but all right.
You can't please Connor, but that's okay. today we are very excited because we have a very special guest. We say all of them are special, but it's true. They all bring something different to the table, figuratively and literally. Thank you, Connor, for making the table.
Yep, you're welcome.
Now, typically we talk about a lot of different political topics that tend to divide people. But I think in this case, this is a topic that you're going to want to really be interested in, whether you're Democrat, whether you're Republican, moderate, independent, unaffiliated, any of those. This is something that we should all be concerned about. And we haven't even had this conversation yet, but I'm already excited about it because I know that Connor and I are both going to learn something new. We know you guys are going to learn something new. Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to introduce to you Hannah Arrowood, the founder of Present Age Ministries that deals with combating sex trafficking. They are going on their 14th year, which is very exciting. And we're very happy to have Hannah here just to talk to us about this subject. Hannah, thank you so much for being here.
I'm so excited to be here with you guys. Right. We'll have some good conversation, I know.
I think we will, too. Even though that intro was a little bit wooden for Connor, I know he's going to go
little,
back.
A little bit forced. Well, that's all right.
But, you know, it's true, though. I mean, that was the thing I talked to you about when we talked on the phone about this, where I was like, I really wanted this to be a conversation that everyone would care about. And sex trafficking, I think some people, obviously a lot of people know about it. If you ask them, they'd be like, oh, it's bad. But I don't think they know a lot of details. And quite frankly, there's a lot of details I don't know because I'm just not in that. I'm just not in that space. So we're like, well, let's bring someone in that's in that space.
Absolutely.
So first and foremost, just tell us a little bit about yourself before we kind of get into all of this.
Okay. So I am the founder of Present Age Ministries, and I'm also have been married for over 20 years, raised two girls, and one is soon to be married and one is in her second year of college. So we are officially empty nesters. Which is fun, which is also why I got a dog.
Okay.
We were talking about the dog earlier.
Yeah.
But it's a fun season of life for us. It's just a new phase, a new chapter of life for us. But it also, you know, to be at the phase of life that we're in really allows a lot of time and attention to be dedicated to present age in a different capacity than you could or would when if you have little kids running around. So right. It's a really fun season for us.
Right. Yeah, because, you know, little kids, I mean, they take up a little bit of time.
They do.
I don't have kids. We don't have kids, but we know that they run around, and they are a little messy depending on the kid. But I want to ask you a very important question before we get into just the meat of the topic. Can you kind of just tell us a little bit about Present Age Ministries and why you even decided to start this ministry?
Yeah. So my background is in business and corporate America. So I spent 10 years in corporate America, you know, doing what you do. You climb the ladder and you do all of the things. And it was just, quite honestly, it was really unfulfilling. You know, mm-hmm. you do and you achieve and you do and you achieve. And for what? What's the result?
Yeah.
So for me, there just came a point specifically in my faith where I was like, okay, God, there's got to be more than this. Like, this can't be it. And just, I was wrestling a lot personally of, I knew that there was, if you will, a calling to something greater and to something more, but do you give up the comfort? Do you want to count the cost? Do you want to wrestle all of that out? And so I spent about 2 years in that place of just wrestling it out, going, okay, am I actually going to do this? Am I going to walk away from the comfort and the security of what I know in corporate America to do what? I mean, that's where I was at.
Yeah.
And so eventually, obviously, I said yes to that. And so Present Age was really birthed with this desire and this heart to minister and reach teen girls. Mm-hmm. If I didn't know 14 years ago, you know, that it was going, you know, 13 years coming up on our 13th anniversary to start our 14th year, that it was going to be sex trafficking and working with those who've been recovered from that exploitation and horrific crime. But what I knew was that the Lord was very clear to me when he spoke. He said, you need to be prepared to go you've got to go beyond the four walls of a church, and I need you to go to the ones that no one wants to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I knew that there was going to be this, if you will, like getting in the mud and getting messy, which I don't consider that now, but that's what my perception was, you know,
sure.
13 years ago. And so here we are, there was just this desire to be obedient and to walk out what I believe that the Lord was speaking to me very clearly. And now here we are, you know, 13 years later.
Yeah.
I didn't know it was going to be this.
Yeah. So wait, you said you were like, okay, I want to reach young girls. How did it become like getting into sex trafficking? Was it just, you noticed that was one of the big things that was a struggle? Like, if it doesn't take too long, how did it get there?
So in those first 2 or 3 years we spent, we were already really involved in preventative measures for a myriad of things. And part of that included being able to travel all over the country mm-hmm. and doing conferences and doing workshops and things like that with crisis pregnancy center boarding schools. You know, these crazy God connections that we were like, how in the world are we getting connected to these places? And it was in those meetings that we started to very clearly see, you know, you'd have a line of girls waiting to talk to you after a conference. And they would, what I would say, word vomit and tell these stories that very quickly began to portray what we now know to be trafficking mm-hmm. and some sort of sexual exploitation and coercion. And so we began to see this trend, and that's just how I'm wired. Like if you see something, I'm going to have to do something. I can't just sit back and watch injustice. It's just not how I've been wired. And I can remember going back to my board going, we have to do something. Like, and I would call my husband from these events in California and Mississippi saying, I think we should just line our house with bunk beds. Like, I'm just going to bring them to my house. And of course, that's not a sustainable solution.
Sure.
So that didn't work long term. But there were these moments of like, we can't unsee this. Mm-hmm. Like, we're watching this happen in every state that we go to. We're watching these stories unfold in every place that we go. Something has to be done. And so we really began to take what the access that we already had through school systems and partnerships and say, how do we really begin to cultivate programming? Because we were able to clearly identify there were gaps. There weren't services and programs for this. And began to just develop programming from there.
Yeah. Well, before I kind of hand it off to Connor, let's talk about, what is sex trafficking? This is the big question. What exactly is it?
Yeah. So sex trafficking, very simply, is the exchange of anything of value for a commercial sex act. And so really, that something of value, it could be money, it could be drugs, it could be shelter, security, you name it. It doesn't have to just be cash. And then, but the exchange has to involve a commercial sex act. which again can be a lot of things. Mm-hmm. It could be a physical sexual act person to person, but it also could be pictures. It could be content also.
Mm. Okay.
And so it's important to understand that. Our federal law says that someone under the age of 18 cannot consent to a commercial sex act. So anything that involves a minor, by definition of our federal law, is deemed sex trafficking. Now, where we get a little bit tricky is some of our state laws are vary when it comes into the age of consent. Like in North Carolina, the age of consent is 16 to engage in
right.
sex.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yep. So if that person is 16 or 17 years old, it gets a little tricky going, did they choose to engage in this?
Yeah.
But if that exchange of value is happening, it's federal law still trumps that. Mm-hmm. It's just a lot more difficult to prove.
Sure. Gotcha. You kind of have the two going against each other a little bit there.
Yeah. Now, I don't think any of our states allow prostitution, but what ends up differentiating yeah. it between prostitution, where somebody's willingly basically using sex as their job, versus being coerced into something?
And that's a great question. And the reality is that it comes down a lot of times to the age. Mm-hmm. And that's what that federal law says, that someone under the age of 18 can't choose that. They can't consent to do that no matter what their age is. You can't be a 15-year-old and say your job is to engage in prostitution.
Yeah.
So if you're over 18, then that's a very different conversation.
Sounds like it gets more complicated at that
point. It's way more complicated because they can say choices that is there. Mm-hmm. But then when you start, oftentimes what we've also learned, especially with minors, is that they don't self-identify as a victim. Whereas typically in any type of, whether it's a theft or whether it's a rape, there's a clear perpetrator and a clear victim. You know, we're not debating those facts. Whereas in trafficking, oftentimes that relationship can look very manipulated and they have been groomed. Mm-hmm. So oftentimes that perpetrator, that trafficker, is presented as boyfriend. And so that creates even another layer of complication, because 15-year-old thinks that this person's their boyfriend, where boyfriend mm-hmm. is actually have manipulated and groomed in for the purposes of trafficking.
Right.
But there's a loyalty and there's a bond that's been established that now creates a layer of confusion we have to work through.
Okay. So question here. I think there's kind of this misconception, and I had it for a while, especially as a kid, that like sex trafficking was like you get kidnapped and someone takes you away. Like, is that really how it happens, or is it more of like more psychological bondage opposed to like actual captivity?
Correct. So oftentimes if we talk about initial recruitment, let's break that down. If we talk about initial recruitment, oftentimes there isn't mm-hmm. forced kidnapping.
Okay.
And that's where it's not like the movie Taken, right?
Yeah, yeah. That's what I was thinking right there. I was like, yeah, it sounds like Liam Neeson's Taken. Yeah.
Exactly. Which, by the way, I love those movies, right? You know, I am that type of movie and TV show girl all day long. But that's just not typically what it looks like, especially mm-hmm. here from a domestic trafficking standpoint in the United States. That's just simply not the norm. Can it happen? Of course it can happen, but it's just not the norm. And so oftentimes, especially when we're talking about minors, what we see happening is that manipulation and coercion through a very intentional strategic grooming.
Okay.
And so they're identifying a need, they're exploiting a need, their relationship becomes sexualized. Now there's a trauma and that has been an exploitive of emotional security. Mm-hmm. Now there's sexual connection that has happened and it's, oh, now I need you to do me a favor. Well, now there's information, there's context about this person. Oftentimes there's even information to blackmail them, videos, pictures, all of these things that now makes it very easy for a trafficker to continue to coordinate what he's trying to do to that victim.
Okay. That makes sense to me. What would be like an example? So you said, what would be like a common example of grooming, like a scenario that you see pretty often?
13-year-old is on social media talking mm-hmm. about how they hate their parents and their life and nobody understands them. Mm-hmm. Right? How many 13-year-olds say things like that?
Oh, I did when, right. But I didn't have social media.
Thank God. You know? That's what, you know, and that's the reality. We see that a lot. And so there are people that are out there trolling social media mm-hmm. that just then responds is like, oh my gosh, I can't believe, what do you mean your family doesn't understand you? I think you're amazing. All of these mm-hmm. things that now feels like there is an established connection, and that established connection at the core of every teenage girl, this is 100% of every girl that we've ever worked with at present age, which is, you know, close to 400 at this point.
Wow.
Right. So it's not a few. We have a little bit of data now behind us. Every one of them wants to be loved and accepted and valued. And so they're looking that for that desperately. And so said trafficker comes along and says, you're beautiful, and says, I can't believe they don't understand you. I think you're amazing. I think you're great. Hey, let's meet at said mall or a coffee shop. And they start to build this, what feels like a very real relationship, but they've been targeted from the beginning.
Wow.
How often is it a stranger that comes into a child's life versus a close family member or an actual family member or somebody from school, basically somebody from a position of authority?
So we do see familial trafficking happen. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't have an exact percentage. I mean, I would say it's fairly common. I'd say, you know, 15-25% of the time there is a family dynamic involved, mm-hmm. or someone's involved in that trafficking. But what we often find is it's somebody that they have met or interacted with online.
Gotcha.
So again, they would tell you that they know this person because they've interacted with them for what, 2 days, 2 weeks, 2 months, who knows? But to them, it's not a stranger. Mm-hmm. But for most of us on the outside looking in, that's a stranger to you that you've just created a connection with. While it's a false connection, it's a fake connection that's been manipulated. It's not somebody necessarily they went to school with. It's not necessarily somebody in their neighborhood. It's not a physical person that they've met up until that first decision to meet. Does that make sense?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Do you ever run across young boys, or do you only work with young girls?
So present age is specific to working with teen girls, specifically mm-hmm. because that's where the greatest need is. And we do get called on occasion to do consulting for if an identified boy is a victim that has a boy is identified. Mm-hmm. But it's rare. You know, if you think about the stigma that there is to come forth when a female has been sexually assaulted or sexually abused, that's still such a hard conversation to have. Mm-hmm. And it's even greater for boys.
Yeah, they normally get applauded for something like
correct.
That. And we've talked about at length sometimes the way the school systems have been run, the amount of teachers that are sexually exploiting young boys who are underage, and nothing comes of it.
Exactly.
Maybe they get a couple months of community service, but it's never considered a rape, where if you had switched it around
correct.
And made it a male teacher with a female student, it's a much harsher punishment.
Yeah.
And the reactions are much more vitriol to that.
And that's what we see happen, especially when a lot of times the boys that we have had interactions with, a lot of them also have history of a sexual abuse. Mm-hmm. So there's a great deal of shame involved, and there's a great deal, sometimes they're struggling with sexuality or identity. And so there's many layers to the fact that they don't come forward. Or if you go back to what I said at the beginning, most victims under the age of, at least for minor ones that we deal with, they don't self-identify as a victim. So again, we're expecting them to come forward and use to have vocabulary to explain to us what's happening. Mm-hmm. And that's just not the norm.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a couple questions from what you said. So you mentioned social media mm-hmm. a couple of times. I guess I want to know, how strong is the connection between social media and sex trafficking? And then, well, actually, let me just ask that, and then I'll ask you a follow-up question.
Okay. I don't have actual statistics. I can say, you know, this many out of this many, but I will tell you it's a very high rate.
Yeah.
So when it comes to recruitment, it's very active. There's recruitment that's done on social media. Every platform, pick a platform, it's happened.
I was going to say, which platforms
all
do you see
them.
The most?
All of them. There's all and that's them. The thing. There's not a very specific one. Everything from Facebook to Instagram to TikTok to Snapchat.
So they're
you
just
name it.
Everywhere.
They're everywhere. Games, Fortnite. I mean,
wow.
you pick it, Grand Theft Auto. If there is a way to do private chats, it's happening.
Gotcha. Okay. Okay.
So we see that a lot.
Okay. And then the second thing to that, because we have these, okay, we have these girls and they're complaining about their parents, and, you know, just kind of give me, not like a statistic, but just like your rough opinion on, are these girls, the ones that are getting trafficked, are they coming from really broken homes, or are they coming from homes that are genuinely good, teenagers acting out, goes on social media, and the parents have no idea what's going on? How does that happen?
Yes and yes.
Okay.
And this is one of those, of course there are vulnerabilities that mm-hmm. Create a heightened risk, right? So when there is what we monitor and measure what we call adverse childhood experiences. There are 10 things that there was a study done by the CDC and Kaiser Permanente that monitored what we call adverse childhood experiences. So we look at all of those with all of the girls that we work with. And there are 10 of those that we look at. So for simplistic sake, it's any type of abuse. So physical abuse, emotional abuse, or sexual abuse. We're looking at physical and emotional neglect. And then they have five, what they call household challenges, which includes incarceration of a parent, mm-hmm. Or a guardian, mental health within the family. So parents or guardians or grandparents have a mental health issue, substance abuse issues, homelessness, and parent separation. So out of those 10 things, what we have found, again, over the last decade of working with survivors is that when there's a past sexual abuse, when there's past emotional neglect, and when there's parent separation, the rate of victimization skyrockets. Mm. Okay. So among our identified victims of trafficking, those are the three most prevalent vulnerabilities that we see playing out. And I think if we all were to stop and think about that, it would make perfect sense, right? Yeah. Yeah. If you have parent separation, you're desperate to be loved. Where do I belong? Right. Who am I? That identity piece is so you're desperate to find. Past sexual abuse, boundaries and trust has been confused oftentimes at an early age. So you don't necessarily have the radar to say this is bad or good or right or wrong. Right. And that emotional neglect, a lot of times there has been struggle with attachment. So they attach too quickly to people because, again, they're desperate for that connection that sometimes they don't have an appropriate radar to recognize this person means harm to me.
Yeah. And, you know, I think it's honestly very unfortunate because social media in itself is an attention-seeking app. And so you're mm-hmm. putting, honestly, to a certain extent, I mean, I'm making a claim perhaps I can't substantiate, but it seems like almost pretty much every teenager on there could potentially be at risk because a lot of them are seeking attention and they've kind of almost, I'll use the term lightly, but groomed by social media and psychologically told if I post this picture, I post this bikini picture, you know, I'm going to get that instant gratification. So a certain extent, they kind of groom themselves a little bit. That's just me thinking out loud a little bit because I have a big thing with social media. And so you get these girls on there that now you said something about like emotional neglect mm-hmm. and that sounds like that could vary a bit. Could it, and this might be a more technical question, could it be from their own perception of emotional neglect? Or is it from like the definite neglect of like a father or a mother, like just kind of
so with
feeling
the,
that out?
Yeah, with the ACEs, the adverse childhood experiences, they were measuring what they experienced. The study was with adults mm-hmm. looking back on their childhood.
Okay.
So it's not necessarily real time that 14-year-old that we're meeting with is saying, I'm being emotionally neglected.
Sure.
So, but by the true definition of emotional neglect, is there care, compassion, and love being withheld from a child? And so oftentimes we see that in a lot of victims that have been trafficked, whether they could live with biological mom or, you know, biological dad, but mom tells them all the time that they are stupid and that they're never going to amount to anything and they were a mistake and wish they were never born. That would be classified as emotional neglect.
Okay. How do you guys go about trying to get parents more involved to monitor what their kids are doing online or with their phones?
Because
texting as well.
Yeah, part of it is just education. You know, at present age, one of the things that we take very seriously is not just talking about the problems, but giving solutions.
Yep.
And so talking with parents about like, listen, don't be naive. Your kids know 100% more than you do about social media and online. Mm-hmm. And so don't pretend like they don't. You know, first of all, let's just start there. You know, you can have, so we talk a lot about parental controls. We talk a lot about what social media apps, what their purpose is from the beginning. Like, why were they developed in the first place? You know, and all of these things, like what are tools, what are monitoring software, what are things that mm-hmm. you can put in place? Because at the end of the day, your job is to protect your child, not be friends with your child.
Yes.
And
yes.
We have to start there because none of us would ever give a 12-year-old a gun.
Right.
And say, good luck figuring it out. Mm-hmm. I hope you can figure out how to clean it. I hope you can figure out how to make sure it doesn't get jammed. Here's a safety lock. Hope you can know how to undo it. None of us would ever do that. We would think it's so stupid. But we hand our kids devices at 3 years old, 5 years old, 6 years old. And they're like, oh, well, they won't figure out how to get on these sites and these things. Really?
Yeah.
And so we have to just be smarter about how we are raising this generation in a world that is very different than when we were growing up.
Yeah. My dad used to give almost the exact example as he would talk to parents and he would ask them, like, do you leave a loaded gun on the counter for your kids to find? And that was usually the example he gave when asking them if they had any type of monitoring software or anything to limit what their kids were doing, where they were going, or at least tracking it. And I was actually going to ask, like, what software is out there that you guys recommend? Because I've been through dozens of them, and they seem to do one of two things. Either they track absolutely everything, and so you're just cluttered with information. They're Googling how to microwave a Pop-Tart or something stupid like that. You just have everything. And you're like, yeah. I can't find, you know, if there is something bad in here. And, you know, they've been visiting a site, and I need to know about it. It's just buried in information. I've had other ones that don't do anything. And then I've had others that block access to everything. Mm-hmm. I think that one of them blocked me from Google one time. But it blocked it for like profanity mm-hmm. in the name Google. And I was like, there's nothing in here. So like we would try other sites. It wouldn't let us. My family even had a Christian domain email or something like that. It was like the worst acronym ever. I think it was flmtgif.org.
Wow.
Was a domain. It was horrible. I couldn't even remember what it all stood for at this point, but something family and it's just ridiculous. But we couldn't even get to that because whatever software they got was just so strict mm-hmm. because it just saw a big acronym. It blocked us from it. So yeah. It was like, all right, well, this one doesn't work.
Yeah.
So what have you guys found to be the most effective, and where has software gone these days for monitoring?
So there's actually several good ones, and I can give you a list of ones.
And we'll put it in the description for mm-hmm. people so that for they sure. can find them.
But there are several ones out there that are more user-friendly mm-hmm. than they used to be, so that there you can put in different things and you can set parameters different based on the age and things like that. So it has come some way. I'm not going to say a long way, but it has come some way that allows there to be some sort of guidance. And the reality is that technology these days, whether it be your routers, whether it be your phones and devices, they actually have things built in them that you can do that is mm-hmm. just a great place to start. You know, you can put passcodes required in order to download an app, right? That's something that any parent can do without a monitoring system.
Right.
You know, require a passcode that only you know, that if they want to download an app, they have to have that passcode and come ask for your permission, right?
Yeah,
on your router, you can put on permissions that cut the internet off after a certain hour mm-hmm. that nobody needs to be on the internet at 2 o'clock in the morning. Right. No. So just set parameters within your own household that, you know, at 10 o'clock, the internet gets cut off unless you've asked to work on an assignment and you're doing that right. in the kitchen. Right. There's things that you can do even outside of monitoring software that could put protections in place that also just tells your child that, oh, wait, there's going to be some safeguards in place that I have to understand how to work within.
Right. And the thing with parents too, I think that's really good that you guys actually talk to parents, where I think, because when you're mentioning like, oh, you know, they don't think their five-year-old can, they can. Like I have seen 2 and 3-year-olds navigate an iPad better than I can.
Correct.
It's insane.
Correct.
And honestly, kids aren't, they're stupid, but they're smart at the same
time.
They're
so smart.
Yeah, it's a weird combination because sometimes you do things are really smart and then sometimes you're like, oh, that's a really bad idea.
Yeah.
It's a super bad idea. But these kids, they know how to manage a device. And so, and I'm going to maybe come at parents a little bit here, but I know it's so easy to just give them an iPad and be like,
it becomes a babysitter.
It does. And you know, I'm not a parent, but I know a lot of parents, like it's hard and you want that relief.
You need 30 minutes and you can turn on, you know, Lululemon or no, that's not Melon.
That's a brand. It's a very expensive and bougie brand.
It is. Shows you how long it's been since I've had littles.
Barney.
Yeah. Right.
But VeggieTales.
You get 30 minutes. Right. If I turn this on for 30 minutes, my child is going to be entertained,
mm-hmm. right.
which every parent needs 30 minutes. Like I need to cook dinner. I need to do a load of laundry. I need to, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
But the reality of it is that during that 30 minutes, chances are an ad pops up.
Well, right.
Or they just start sliding. They're not meaning to do anything, but they're sliding. The next thing
sure.
that you know,
yeah.
they're on YouTube looking at something and that's the thing. It's what we've experienced in just doing prevention work in the communities, you know, across a wide range of places is that most of the time when children stumble all upon things, it's never usually by intention.
Yeah. It's usually by accident.
It's usually by accident, right. But then what do I do? Mm-hmm. And so it's also even equipping parents to know, like, you need to start the conversations. Don't wait for your child to come to you because, again, shame and embarrassment, oftentimes, if they feel like they've done something wrong. I mean, you know, here's a little Bible lesson, y'all. Faith is important to me. You go back to Genesis, when Adam and Eve felt they did something wrong, they hid in shame, mm-hmm. right? They went to hide. So our kids are oftentimes, when they feel like they've done something wrong, unless the foundation has been set by that family that it's okay for you to come and talk to me about those things, chances are they're not. So they saw that pornography on accident at 6 years old, 8 years old, yeah. 9 years old. You know, they saw this video that was all with all kinds of profanity and learned colorful four little words. Well, they don't necessarily know what to do with that information. And so one of the things that we encourage parents to do all the time is just start, when your kid hits middle school, you should be having open conversations with them about things like this. Like, so have you stumbled upon pornography, been exposed to pornography yet? Have any of your friends, what do they talk about? Like, mm-hmm. just start the conversation, because chances are 9.9 out of 10 times, the answer is yes, they just don't know how to have those conversations. Mm-hmm. But if you can build that trust that those conversations are okay to have, then if and when they get themselves in a situation that is potentially dangerous, there's a lot more chance that they're going to come forward and have those conversations.
Right. I mean, it's just that openness, because I mean, pornography, you know, things like that, it's very prevalent. Like, mm-hmm. and there's a really high chance that they've all been exposed to it. It's just, especially if you're in a school, if you have friends, it's going to happen to a certain extent. I make an argument that even there's soft porn all around you.
Correct.
Right.
Oh yeah.
So I think it is really important. Just be like open, be like, hey, have you seen porn? It's okay. I just need to know. Like,
correct.
It's okay. I think that's an entirely different conversation than coming down super hard at them. Cause they're probably confused. They're trying to figure things out. And so I've been a kid myself, you know, it's kind of, sex is kind of a weird, strange conversation.
It's like a taboo thing. Have a conversation about.
It is very taboo.
Yeah.
But with these parents that you talk to, do you find that they're like, really? Wow. Or they're like, we already knew this, or somewhere in between?
I think what we have typically, obviously you'll have some in the middle, but I think we find really extremes.
Really?
You know, you have families and parents who are like, really, they want to protect their child, but are almost like that helicopter parent, really, that is really overbearing, and they think that they've put everything in place to do it, but can almost feel suffocating to the child.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
To some extent. But then you also have ones that are like, not my child. This would never happen. They don't even know what sex is. Okay. You know, so sometimes it feels like we're operating in these extremes of like trying to create a balance to go, okay, maybe, but unless you're going to have your child live in a bunker for the next 10 years, they're going to be exposed to something.
Right.
It's almost impossible to not have them be exposed. And I think that we also have to ask the question. We're asking the wrong question. The question isn't, have you been exposed and therefore you've failed if they have. The question is that when they're exposed, where do they go?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And so I can remember, you know, doing this, I was raising two daughters during this past, you know, 13 years. And every time I would learn something from one of our girls at present age, I would go home, like an app or, you know, some type of website or something like that. And I would go home to my girls and say, hey, have you heard of da 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 da? And they're like, yeah, mom. And I'm like, I could never keep up. And it's my job.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. It's like, so changing for parents, taking the pressure off of like, you're not going to keep up.
Yeah.
That you're not going to keep up. And that doesn't mean that you're a bad parent. Mm-hmm. The thing that you can do is create a place where their conversations are allowed and easy to have, so that when it happens, there's an ability to have those conversations with them.
Right.
Yeah. So that means you really do have to be an involved parent, not a helicopter parent,
right.
Not a distant one, but just one that's involved. And
absolutely.
I think you said earlier, you know, not to rely on the iPad or the TV or the computer as to be the babysitter for the kid. I think we could probably say the same for the monitoring software as well.
Correct.
Don't just leave it to that to try and catch your kid. You know, you obviously want to create a space where your kid can come to you mm-hmm. proactively.
Absolutely.
And tell you that they ran into it and not have you find out in the, you know, after the fact.
Absolutely. That's great.
Yeah. And so now this one, I think a lot of people are pretty aware of. I'm switching gears from parents a little bit, but this will probably get into parents too. With sex trafficking and pornography, I'm going to assume that the link is incredibly high.
Correct.
Yep.
Okay.
Correct.
Just gonna put it out there.
The
make sure everyone knows. But also, I had asked this question to you before. So when I ask it to you, you know, pretend you're surprised.
Okay.
with COVID-19, so everyone was locked down, wasn't going anywhere. And one of the questions we went to volunteer at your guys' new space, which we'd love for you to, we'd love to talk to you about, you know, more about what your ministry is doing specifically. But I was kind of curious. I was like, Hannah, with COVID-19, I was like, did you guys see like a spike in sex trafficking and you were able to kind of give me an answer and kind of explain it a little bit.
Absolutely. So back when in March of 2020, I can remember the Monday after COVID, you know, was announced and that things began to shut down. And I can remember sitting in my office and this was a thought I had. This is the perfect storm. And here's what I mean by that. We very quickly saw things progress where, you know, school shut down, everything went online, everything went virtual. Right. Well, we know as an agency that works with victims of trafficking that the number one recruitment is online. Mm-hmm. So there's that fear just increased and went through the roof. Now you also have kids who have no access to adults in their life, right? Mm-hmm. Well, we know that our victims of trafficking don't self-identify as a victim. So we really rely on community people in community engagement to identify a victim of trafficking. And that now is no longer a possibility. So we have kids online at home. We have kids who are not interacting with adults who are trained to know what to look for. Mm-hmm. And we have kids who have high rates of mental illness, anxiety issues, already issues that they were dealing with and now know where to get help and services for that. And so that all begins to happen in the, you know, the next 6 months, then it became a year and then it became 18 months. All of this starts to play out. And about 6 months after COVID hit, when people started to do some things again, you know, and the world started to open up again, we started to get double referrals a month than what we had gotten historically. And that has continued, you know, in different waves. And what we just have realized, it just exacerbated the issues that were already at play and put like a magnifying glass on them. And that's what I think people need to know is trafficking didn't stop.
No.
You know, listen, this might be a newsflash to you, but those that are willing to pay to have sex with a child don't care about COVID. They were still paying to have sex with a child.
Yeah.
And that's the reality. Mm-hmm. And so while, you know, police may not have been able to respond and while social workers couldn't go do a well checkup and all those things couldn't happen, traffickers could still traffic young girls. Yeah. And so it just created this chasm where, you know, those of us that work in this world and those with our counterparts were scrambling in a lot of sense of the word to try to figure out how to mitigate the results, what we were watching happen.
That's just disgusting to me. It's heartbreaking. I know that your heart probably breaks every day.
I actually just get really mad.
Yeah.
To be really honest.
Yeah. I mean, it was just sad. I was in traffic on the way here and I was super angry. And when I get angry, I get hungry. I don't know if that's the same for you, but
that's hangry, Jordan.
No, yes. It's not the
did
same.
Did you have dinner? That's
I did not have dinner. So I might need some after this, but this is the stuff that really angers me. But I mean, what you guys are doing is, I know it can be hard, like, probably you want to focus on that perpetrator, and I hope that there's better legislation that's making it out there. I don't know if you guys are involved in any legislation or not, but we'd love to talk about that too. But you guys are really offering a lot of the care to those victims.
Yeah.
And the thing too, it must be hard because, like you said, they don't self-identify.
Yeah.
So that has to be kind of difficult. How do you get them to come to you guys?
Yeah. So for us, we work very closely with, you pick an agency that works with children. So Youth and Family Services, your traditional DSS, Child Advocacy Centers, law enforcement, both local, state, and federal, Atrium Healthcare's emergency health rooms, all of those we work really closely with in order to train and equip and make sure they know how to identify so that when they do, and when there's a suspicion of a child that might be exploited or trafficked, they then call and refer them to us. And so it's then in that intake process for us where our team, and we always go in a team of two, and goes and does, the initial goal was to meet with whoever this child is and said guardian. So whether that's parent, foster care, you know, grandma, whatever, whoever guardian is, because child has to agree to engage in services. Choice has been taken from them. And so we have to provide an opportunity for them to choose to engage in the services and the support that we're providing. And usually they're like, well, I don't need you. right? Because again, self-identify. Mm-hmm. And so how we present it really matters. And again, we have to walk a fine line. We never want to manipulate or false present who it is that what we're doing. But recognizing, walking up and saying, you're a victim of trafficking and you need our help.
Probably not.
It's never going to work.
Yeah.
Yeah, right? Probably not.
And so we present it the way that I told to talk to you guys earlier. You know, I bet you're 14 years old and I bet you really want to be loved and accepted somewhere and you want people just to believe in you and to help you figure out what the next few years of your life looks like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's a good
and the answer
present.
Is yes. Yeah. And so in the process, we have three pillars that we really think about when we're working with our girls. We rebuild trust, restore hope, and then redefine love. And it has to happen in that order. You know, that first 30, 60 days, our goal is to just build trust with them. They have to trust us before we can start to talk about a different way of life, right? And looking at what can hope actually look like outside of what's happened to you, outside of the trauma, beyond the fact that your dad left you when you were three and your neighbor raped you and, you know, all of the things that come along with their story. It's not, usually trafficking isn't the worst thing that's happened to them. Huh. And that is hard for you and I to wrap our brain around, but that's consistently the response. This is just another thing that's happened to me. It's not the worst thing that's happened to me. So they really need a space to build that trust and start to learn that they can hope again on their time. It can't be a prescribed, like, well, within 60 days, you should be doing this.
So you have a lot of patience then.
Well, I have a team who has a lot of patience, yes. But it just requires, we are consistent. We show up. And that's what, you know, when we're training case managers and we're training our team, you know, one of the things that we say for the first 30, 60 days, if they show up, that's a win.
Mm. Yeah.
I think I asked you when we were out volunteering, but how often do you get girls that have been rescued from trafficking?
Yeah.
It sounds like a lot of the ones you're talking about right now are being groomed into it.
So no, these are the girls that are also trafficked.
Okay.
So I'll give you an example. This is a little bit heightened for us normally, but in a last week we received 7 referrals in 1 week.
Wow. Okay, that's a lot.
Correct.
And you guys are just to clarify for the audience, you guys are just in Charlotte, North Carolina?
So our home base is in the Charlotte metro area. So we serve about a 7-county radius. So any county that touches Mecklenburg County, we also provide services and work in. But that's for our direct services with those that have been identified as trafficking victims.
So these 7 that you got, these were Charlotte?
Correct.
Okay. Okay, go ahead, continue.
Well, and so that was in a 1 week time period. It's very common for us to receive anywhere from 4 to 8 new referrals a month for those that have been identified as victims of trafficking.
Okay. So you're trying to, I think you're trying to figure out like,
when are they at risk versus, yes.
Yeah, those that are being groomed versus those who are maybe
who have been rescued
out
of it,
know it.
Correct.
And then those who are like physically pulled out of a trafficking situation.
So normally if a child gets connected to present age, it's because they're not self-identifying that they're in it. It's because someone has recognized something is off and something is wrong and they make a referral to us. And even in that intake, even in that sometimes first 30 days, 60 days, they're like, I mean, I'm doing this by my choice. Nobody's making me do this.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they are. Mm-hmm. And that's the point. Like by federal law, they can't choose at 13 years old.
Right. No, they
can't. So like, it's also understanding that's why it's so important as the adults around them have to understand the context of the law because they can say that and actually believe that.
Right. Yeah. No, there's a lot of things I believed when I was 15. They weren't true.
Correct. So for us, it's that mixture of that, what you were saying that, you know, B and C, if you will, like there's those that are at risk that are just high levels of vulnerabilities. Mm-hmm. But then there's those that are being in it. And then those that are being pulled out. Those are really like the same category for us.
Okay.
I was going to say, because it feels like those categories can kind of almost mix a little bit. There's not like this fine, there's not like this bold line that's like, you're in this category, that
Correct.
Category or this category.
And sometimes those that have been pulled out of it and that have been engaged in services with us for 2-3 months, go back.
Really?
Well, because remember, that was my boyfriend and he loves me.
Yep.
Mm, yep. That's that manipulation.
It's psychological. There's that trauma bond. It's like Stockholm syndrome. There's that trauma bond that's been established. And even though they don't want to be engaged in that, this person was meeting a need that no one else in my life is meeting. And so you taking me out of that scenario actually takes away that meeting of the need, even though it's done in an unhealthy manner. And so it's, We have girls that are in programming, active programming, and run away. We know they're with said trafficker, and they'll still call their case manager. I just want you to know I'm okay. Well, where are you? Get your tail home, right? But for them, home is worse.
Yeah. Mm.
And so it really, that's why it's a messy, complicated thing. I think as a society, we just think, oh, they've been rescued. They're going to be grateful and thankful, and we can move on with our merry lives. That's just not what it looks like. Mm-hmm. It's complicated. There's layers. It gets messy, and there has to be an ability to respond consistently, going, no matter how many times it takes, we're going to be here, and because you matter. And I think that's the dynamic that we often play with the girls that we're working with.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Now, because we're here, since you're local to Charlotte, we're local to Charlotte, let's talk about the Charlotte area.
Let's.
Are there hotspot areas where trafficking
the answer
is
yes.
more prolific? Yeah.
She was quick on that
the answer
one.
Is yes.
Great. What are those areas?
Okay. Anywhere that you have a gathering, mm-hmm. you're going to have potentially recruitment.
So I'll be specific
Please
for
do.
People who are in Charlotte, but I think this would probably apply generally to, mm-hmm. to any area, like Concord Mills Mall.
Correct.
Is that a big...
Any really, malls in general are such a... Think about it. Young
that's
people,
where all the teenagers...
Young
yeah.
people like
yeah.
to go hang out. So
I
it's
never
easy.
Understood why.
I don't either, but it's the truth. But it's a great place for traffickers to go mm-hmm. and just act we've actually had from a trafficker say, I would go to a mall and just walk around and look for a group of girls.
Okay, I have a weird thing here, okay? Mm-hmm. Like, when I see, just a random guy just walking around, just doing nothing, in the middle of the day, am I weird to think that maybe there could potentially be something going on, or am I just reading into it, right?
I mean,
being too
probably...
You're sexist.
It's
Wow.
I think it could probably be both. You know, I mean, I think that's the thing. It's and it's so hard, not to be quick to judge mm-hmm. in this, especially when there's potentially such danger. But here's what I can tell you. When I was sharing that story, trafficker says, I'm looking for a group of girls. I walk up. Let's say there's three girls, and I say, man, you look really beautiful. Well, the one that is uncomfortable and won't make eye contact with me is the one that I'm going to target.
Yep. And that makes sense, because they're the most vulnerable.
Insecure in themselves. Yeah. They're the most, they have the least amount of confidence. And it's not like he kidnaps her and takes her to a white van, which is kind of what
I always imagined mm-hmm. in my brain was oh no, if I lost my mommy, mm-hmm. I'll get kidnapped.
I could, but that doesn't mean you're being trafficked.
Right.
But in that scenario, what we have heard play out is that guy, they'll just keep walking. Right. So now, but what does that 13-year-old now feel? That 15-year-old now feel? Well, he just paid attention to her.
Yep.
Yeah.
And paid her a compliment. So she is now looking for him as they walk the mall. Mm. He's not looking for her per se. Right. It's this beginning of this manipulation.
So she thinks that she's more finding him supposed to.
Right.
Him
so they run into
going.
Each other in the food court, or they run into each other, at this store. Well, now it just is almost like this little bit of a game, right? And there's this, there's the flirting, and it's this eye contact, all the things. They eventually hey, we should exchange information, whether that's social media or whether that's, phone numbers. Well, now this person, this child, this 13-year-old, this 15-year-old is like, man, he really likes me.
Yeah. And she's convinced it was her idea.
Correct. Right. So it can literally be that simple.
It's just so sinister.
It is.
Deeply sinister.
And I think that what happens, you play that out, they text back and forth, they end up meeting, they end up sexualizing things. Well, she just feels like she's this special person, right? Mm-hmm. But now he's hooked her. And now it becomes a means of coercion. And it literally can be that simple. I think we can overcomplicate this oftentimes, especially with our teenage girls. And, that is so often what we see happening. So we go back and you asked about Charlotte. So malls are a big area where that can happen. So are sporting events. So is the airport. All of these things that gather large people, it's just an easy place to find vulnerable girls.
Right.
That's the why. It's not so much the location as it is who's populating the location.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, no, that makes sense to me.
Yeah, it does. You mentioned that you had a conversation with a trafficker who said that he would just walk the malls. How did that conversation come about?
From our law enforcement friends, but the conversation also continued.
I was going to say,
how did that happen?
I would have probably ended in jail.
Yeah.
But the conversation also continued of, well, one of the questions I get asked all the time is, are you ever scared? You know, like, are you ever worried that these people are going to come after, you know, come after you guys? And again, from the, out of the words of a trafficker's mouth was, it's a much easier to replace her than it is to chase her.
That is so, like, it's
I can
twisted.
Find five more.
Yeah.
I can find five more just like her. Why am I going to waste my energy? She doesn't know my real name. She doesn't know really information about me. So the chances of me actually getting, like, dinged with this are very low. And she also thinks she's in love with me, and she's not going to ever turn on me.
Wow.
That's the perspective.
That's pretty demented.
Yeah. That's the perspective oftentimes of traffickers.
It's just sick. I mean, we could go on and on about just kind of how I don't understand how you get to that point of like, I'm a grown man seeking out a girl. It's just insane. And it's so upsetting to me that there's a demand for that. And I think that, I guess there's kind of when you see kind of promotional stuff in regards to sex trafficking, it kind of like shows it like in a dungeon, or there's, you know,
not true.
The chains and all that stuff. So you kind of think it's in a separate world.
Not true.
But like these girls go to school, right?
Every day.
They walk around the mall.
Sometimes they're not in school because they, you know, there's a truancy case of like, cause they're out with friends or they're running away. But the reality of it is that, you know, this is a $1 billion industry. Mm-hmm. Billion with a B. And when the reality of it is that a trafficker can make, you know, $100,000 to $200,000 a year off of one girl cash, you know, and what, let's say he's running two or three, five girls.
That's a good amount of money.
It's a ton of money.
Yeah.
And the reality of it is the reason that you have a trafficker, think about a car dealer. When you go to want to buy a car, you don't go to the manufacturer. You go to a car dealership, right? They act as that middleman. They act as that broker to provide for you what you need. Well, traffickers have a career because there's people demanding to purchase sex from children.
And I don't have anything.
But I think that's the reality that makes it really hard for us to talk about this is that, you know, there is the reason it's a $1 billion industry is because men are and 99% of buyers are men. 99%, mm-hmm. Right? So there are men who have disposable income that are willing to pay, you know, $50, $100, $300, $500 to have this experience with this child. And these girls that are trafficked, there's that middleman, there's that broker, that trafficker, right, who is making them do that 6, 8, 10 times a day.
And wait, okay, I just have to ask this. I don't know if you can answer the question, but they're having this trafficker is having this girl do this 6 to 8 times a day and with different men, mm-hmm. I assume. How, and I don't know if you're going to be able to answer this, how does that happen? How does the trafficker convince that girl that's because I love you? Like is there manipulation involved at that point, or is it just blackmail or
both?
Okay. It's like you tell your family that you're doing this. Or,
correct. It can be if you tell anybody, I'll make your little sister do this. If you don't do what I'm asking you to do, I'll go kill your mom. Mm-hmm. It could be, well, I don't really want you to do this, babe, but I don't know how we're going to pay our bills. And if you don't do this, what are other options? I mean, the excuses and the manipulation tactics are extreme. Or it could just be, I'm going to beat the out of you.
Yeah.
At that point, it could be, I don't actually care what your answer is. You're going to go do it. And they could drag them in the room by their hair and lock them in the room. You know, like it really can, it can range from extremes. And that's, again, what makes it so complicated.
That is, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know.
Have you ever had somebody get out of sex trafficking that was doing the trafficking that comes for counseling or help or how to?
That's a great question. So we have not, mm-hmm. I mean, we've known of a couple cases where, what in the world of trafficking, the oftentimes traffickers, especially if there's any kind of structure to their organization, mm-hmm. they're going to have what is called the bottom. And the bottom is oftentimes the female who is also recruiting other girls and keeping them in line for the trafficker. It's another layer of removal for that trafficker to be identified and it be put on him. But there's been on occasion where the bottom, who was formerly at one point a victim, has now, but is also now causing other girls to do it. So it would technically be charged with trafficker. She's now both.
Wow.
She's been both sides.
Who's wanted help. And we as an agency have just decided we don't mix that for safety and security reasons.
Understandable.
Obviously.
Yes.
But we would make sure that person got services if they are genuinely wanting to get help and get services.
Yeah. I think that actually kind of answered a second question I had, which is I kind of figure it's probably male dominated industry, but I imagine it's not exclusive.
You're 100% correct. It's mostly male dominated, but there are times where you have women who are trafficking lots of time. In my experience, again, this is just through our experience at Present Age and in our world, they were formerly at one point oftentimes victims. And it becomes either I'm going to be forced to do this or I can now get to the place where I don't do it anymore, but somebody else has to do it.
Right.
So it gets complicated.
It is really complicated. And it's super tricky. I think the one thing that sticks out to me that I think is really, that's really important is that you kept saying the word consistency. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's something really important when it comes to love is this consistent, not just like consistently reaching out, I suppose, but being like, no matter what you do, we're going to be here for you. And I think that's probably something that they haven't experienced before. And even if they do run away, you guys will take them back. And that's something that obviously a trafficker is not going to do. It's so sad when it's sad in a weird way, but it's like, I can just, you're irreplaceable to me. And I think when it comes to trafficking, it's exploiting the most vulnerable part of a woman that just says every woman wants to be loved as much as they might say, no, I don't want to be. It's not true.
It's true.
Every woman wants to be loved. And so when there's just something going on in the home and they just exploit that, it's tragic.
It is.
And to a certain extent too, in what you've talked about with some of these cases, where the home is broken, and that's devastating too, where one of the main themes that we kind of have on our show is that there are a lot of things that can be solved with a whole nuclear family.
Correct.
We've noticed every conversation we've had with someone about any topic, it always comes back to that. It comes down to that brokenness that's already there. And so they search for wholeness somewhere else. And and I think, you're a Christian and then we're Christian. So we know the ultimate acceptance and love that we get is from the Lord.
Correct.
But even I've seen in non-Christian families where there's a whole family, they tend to do pretty well overall.
Well, and I think that one of the things that we've learned that we try to model for the clients that we get to serve is reality is, God is the originator of the perfect plan. So when we're looking at how do we establish programs to help victims of trafficking, well, we don't have to get creative. I mean, we have to get creative in how we administer those solutions. But the reality of it is the family unit is the most effective way to minister and to get to the wholeness. And so for oftentimes, when we're looking at working with these girls, while there may be a place for like hospitalization or group homes or things of that nature, it cannot be the end solution because at the end of the day, they cannot get what they're desperately searching for in those environments. And so for us, that's one of the reasons that we as a program will serve the child in whatever that family unit is, because our desire is to see that family become stable and whole so that it can be a healthy place for that child to grow and flourish. And not only just for the child, but chances are a lot of these parents that we work with, whether it's mom, whether it's grandma, whether it's biological dad, have their own history of trauma that they need permission to heal from. And a lot of times what's happening with their child is triggering their own trauma and they just don't know what to do with it. And so coming alongside of them and telling them that, what happened to them at 12 years old was not okay. Mm-hmm. And like giving them permission to heal, but also challenging them to recognize like the way that you're responding is actually from a place of your own trauma and your child deserves better. And so it becomes this effort to not only provide support and healing for that child, but also the family unit.
Yeah, no, that's major. Maybe this is a bad analogy, but you can, give them a fish or teach them how to fish. And I think teaching them how to fish is typically a better solution.
Takes longer.
It does take longer.
It takes a lot longer, but it's worth it in the end.
I would think so. But you talk about your programs. can you kind of just give us an overview of when you take in a girl from trafficking, what do those programs and services look like yeah. for that child?
So we look at, we take a holistic approach to go back to that whole person, and we look at their medical needs, psychological needs, educational needs, relational needs, and spiritual needs. So our case managers do a really good job of working to build out programming that is individualized, that is going to help address that child's need. Not everybody needs tutoring, right? Some excel in school, some really struggle. Not everybody needs to go see a doctor because maybe they have a primary care doctor, whilst others haven't been to the doctor in years and have several STIs that they need to evaluate, right? So every child really is different, which is why it has to be individualized. But every time our case managers are evaluating their cases, they're looking at those five key areas. What's going on medically with them? Are they up to date in making sure their bodies are taken care of? What's going on psychologically? That includes getting individual counseling. That includes group therapy. That includes family therapy mm-hmm. and therapy for the family if they are willing to engage in it. So there's lots of layers to that as well. And we use a lot of different modalities from a therapy standpoint to make sure that that child is getting what they need. Mm-hmm. Educational, again, we work with 17 and under. All of them should be in school.
Yeah.
So that becomes a little bit more difficult thing, because if you think about a child who's been traumatized, their brain is in a lot of times fight, flight, or freeze mode. So the last thing that they're thinking about is how to study for that math test. So there's this reality of helping them stabilize so that they're able to learn how to learn again. And that is a big part of what are the assessments, what grade levels are they really operating at, and how do we get them caught up? All of those things. Do they continue with traditional school? Do they do GED? Do they do online? There's lots of choices that can go into figuring out what is best, again, individually for the clients that we work with at a school level. Relationally, we have a mentor program that we partner individuals with identified victims to help, again, provide a support system that's constantly walking with them to provide just, again, that love and acceptance and support. We also do group therapy, group sessions weekly with those that want to engage with that, where they're getting life skills and they're just learning mm-hmm. things. Like, we talk about how do you manage in money and how, what's a
budget. I think every single high schooler yes. needs that class.
It's true.
Just putting it out there.
We did that class just recently, and one of the girls who's about to be 18 and has been with us for several years was like, this has changed my life. I need this. And she actually took home extra sheets. She goes, I'm broke based on her budget. She was like, I've got to reevaluate some things.
I love that though. That's awesome.
It's just a fun thing. And then of course, spiritually, I think regardless of where they land spiritually, we never require or force any beliefs on the girls that we serve. We're not going to ever take the place of the trafficker mm-hmm. and say, in order to get these things, you have to believe this.
Right.
We're not going to ever do that. But we are a faith-based organization, and we have a foundation that we as people on staff operate from. And chances are at some point or another, they're going to ask us why. Well, why do you do what you do? Why do you keep showing up? Every time I run away and I end up back at X, Y, and Z, you're there. Why? Hmm. Well, why do you keep chasing after me? Like, those questions come every time. And so we're able to then to say, this is what causes me to operate. And it allows them to start to explore and give. One of the things I think that we do really well, because in all of us, there's usually this questioning. Again, where you land is where you land, but there's usually this questioning of where did we come from and is there a God and all of those things. One of the things that I think we give the girls permission to do is ask the hard questions. Mm-hmm. If God was real, why did this happen to me? If God is good, then why did he let these things happen to me? If those questions that have to be answered, those have to be wrestled for them to be able to figure out anything about what they believe spiritually. And so I think we just do a really good job giving them permission to ask those questions and a safe place to explore those answers.
And every teenager needs that. And every person in general needs an opportunity. Like I do, obviously I don't work in sex trafficking, but I work with, at our church, a little group of girls and a little group of teens that are about, 16, 17-ish. And I always tell them, like, you have to, like, don't just believe this because someone else tells you to do this. Like, you gotta wrestle and you gotta struggle with. I'd rather you struggle Correct. With something than be complacent in something you Correct. Think you should do. So I'm a big advocate mm-hmm. for Me critical too. Thinking. We like critical thinking here.
A little bit.
And it's cool that you guys allow that to happen. That's a huge thing.
And it gives them freedom that regardless of where the answer is that they land, they're going to still be they're going to still be valued in our eyes, you know? And I think that that just, that gives them a different level of freedom to ask the questions and to wrestle it out.
Yeah. I mean, Jesus gave us the choice.
Correct.
So, I mean, why wouldn't we give them the choice?
And at the end of the day, at the end of the day for us, you know, I can tell you my heart is that if they get to the place where they want to engage in exploring who God is and who Jesus is and those things, I'd rather be based on a desire to know, not a desire to step into religion. We have no desire to yoke anybody to religion. We want them to understand and what it means to have a relationship with the person and the God that created them, you know? And so it's just presenting it in a different way. Like, this is an invitation into a relationship, not an ask to be a part of a religion. It's a very different perspective.
Yeah, no. And I know there's probably a lot of people that struggle with the kind of the rigid religion that kind of made them want to kind of step away from Christianity or Catholicism. I heard is also a pretty big one that people tend to step away from because it's very rigid. That's just what I've heard.
Yeah. So good.
Yeah. Now, something else that I noticed while we were talking, well, I've noticed a lot, but one of the things I noticed when you were talking was the key part that community plays in this, that's where the only way these people get identified is having kind of, for lack of a better term, people at the lookout.
That's great. You know? That's absolutely right.
So I guess kind of, I mean, I feel like we're kind of getting close to the end here, but I feel like this will take a little bit of time. How can people like be involved on just a regular basis? Like what does that look like to be aware and to be alert?
I think that first and foremost, I'll break it down into two different things. I think first and foremost is be educated and don't believe everything that you watch on TV. Don't let that
that's
be your
education.
That's just
good life advice. I'm going to be honest.
But I think we have to know what trafficking looks like in the area in which you reside. Mm-hmm. Because the way that it looks internationally is not the way that it looks here in Charlotte, is not the way that it looks in Atlanta, is not the way that it looks in California.
That's a great point.
So we have to recognize what's happening in the place that you reside. And recognize that the friend that told you this happened, you know, 6 hours from where you live, doesn't mean that that's what you're looking for in the place that you live. So I think education is a critical thing. And I think for those that are in a professional field of whether it's nursing or law enforcement or as a teacher, a social worker, any of those things, is knowing what you're looking for. What are those things that you're looking for when you're out doing your job? You know, like for teachers, if you see a child that's always fallen asleep or a child that you knew and it's been 2 years or 3 years, you know, they started in sixth grade and now in eighth grade and you hear that their grades are slipping and they were a straight A student or they were always well-groomed and well-maintained and now they're not, like, you're looking for those things that are not normal to what you know to be in that child that would indicate that there's been a significant change in what's happening in their life. And so it just requires us to pay attention. It requires us to be engaged and pay attention. And that's the first thing, is like really be educated about what's going on in your world, in your area, based on what you do. Because what a teacher is looking for is drastically different than what a nurse is looking for in the ER.
So what is a nurse looking for in the ER? Just curious.
Yeah. So oftentimes they're brought in for, there can be physical, like there's been some sort of violence committed towards them. Mm-hmm. Oftentimes that's because they've refused to do whatever they've been asked of. So there can be bruising, broken bones, things of that nature. But a lot of times there's also pregnancies involved. So that could be, there could be a miscarriage happening. There could be someone tried to do an abortion on their own and there was complications. You know, there could be a lot of different things. STDs, STIs, they've come in to get treatment for that. And their older brother dropped them off and is waiting in the lobby. But older brother. Yeah. Oh, I mean, it's all of those things. And so nurses have to learn to ask the right questions. And the biggest thing is, like, if you're in the ER, get the person alone, right? Like, so whoever they're with, like, get them alone and ask questions without that person around them. Because what we also know is a lot of times traffickers don't allow them to fully speak for themselves. They've been given prescribed answers that they're allowed to say. You tell them I'm this, you tell them this is what's going on. And so breaking away from that person to have private conversations can oftentimes be really important and life-saving for them when they present medically. So those things are what anybody can do, just to be educated. But for those of us that are just in the community, you know, wanting to be a good citizen and wanting to live and be a part of what's happening in our community, get involved. You know, agencies like Present Age, and there's several of us out there. And if you're not in North Carolina, all over, a lot of times, you know, grassroots nonprofits thrive on volunteers. Mm-hmm. And so there's this need, like, we need always 2 to 3 times what we have capacity for, you know? Yeah. So it's get connected and get involved in a way that actually can invest in the life of someone. But that means you have to be consistent and reliable and dependable. You know, we don't always need 40 volunteers on a Saturday afternoon for 3 hours. Like, that's not what we need. We need 40 volunteers to commit an hour a week and commit for a year. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, and so it just looks different. And that, you know, that means that we have to become less busy. That means we have to become a little bit, you know, sacrificial in our time and in our service. And phases of life matter. You know, it's really hard sometimes for young moms to do that with kids at home, you know. And so we get all of that. But the reality of it is that we, as organizations who serve these victims and want to see them thrive and become survivors, it takes an army for us to have the support behind us to do it.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense.
What type of volunteer work is available?
That's a great question. If I mentioned it, you could probably volunteer and do it. So anything from like providing, again, think about all the appointments we're getting these young girls to.
Yeah, that's
true. None of them drive.
Mm. Well, yeah. That's right, because they're like 13.
Because they're 14, 13. 15, so like think about taking, you know, 15 to 20 girls to counseling every week. Mm-hmm. Think about the logistics that goes behind just that.
Yep. Nope. Okay. That's a lot.
So like helping provide transportation, bringing meals to group programs, helping, you know, be a tutor, be a mentor, you know, be a group leader. Like there's all of these things that, and all of those require a different level of commitment. And so those are ways that you can, information that you can find out about, but we have a pretty streamlined volunteer process. Our volunteer entry process is virtual. It's an online volunteer information session that tells you a little bit more about Present Age and the different avenues of volunteering. And then that second tier of training is very specific to the program. So whether it's advocacy, whether it's prevention, or whether it's working directly with survivors, it outlines what that training is and what the background check requirements are and all of those things.
Okay, because I was literally going to ask, is like, oh, if I do any of these things, like play devil's advocate, be like, I don't know how to interact with victims and all that stuff. Like, will you correct, help with that and make sure we don't, correct, you know, I imagine there's just things that we can say, things we can't say in those types of situations that are much more sensitive.
Correct. And part of that training that we do, especially if you have a desire to work directly with those that have been identified as a victim, it's about 15 hours total in training. So you're not just thrown out there. And then you have regular contact with our staff. You know, like you're never like, hope it goes well, we'll see you later. You know? It's definitely a partnership where there's close interaction with our team that is on staff to make sure that you have information that you need, but not more information than necessary, and all of those things, so that it really is a partnership.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. And oh my gosh, I was gonna say this might be the end, but I have another question. I can't help it. I can't help it. Like she keeps saying things. I'm like, oh, I have a question about that. I was thinking about this the other day. Before we have these interviews, like I'm always just like mulling over like what we're going to talk about and just the different scenarios and all these things. I just think too much. And then from thinking, my mouth goes, you know, it's out there.
I love it.
That's Jordan.
Yeah. Connor's like the more silent type. And then he asks really deep,
really poignant questions.
Then I ask why is the sky blue? And you're like, oh, okay, whatever. Right. But anyway,
one of the abstract questions.
Right. He's the more straightforward guy.
That's kind of my role in this.
Yes.
It's a good balance.
It is. It's why we do this together. But with abortion, I was curious about that. What exactly, is there a tie with sex trafficking and abortion? That's all I have. That's it. Like, what does that look like exactly? Because I have no idea.
We'll present it a little bit of a different way. There is a high rate of abortion within those who have been victimized of trafficking.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So that being said, I mean, we know it's a real thing. And I'll share this story because I think it's when this came out, when, you know, Roe versus Wade was overturned, you know, of course I believe in the protection of unborn children, right? Like that's at a personal level. That's that is a belief that I hold strongly to. And as a teenage mom who was faced with that choice, do I keep this baby or do I have her, you know, at 17 years old, I feel like I have a little bit of a say in having that opinion. But what I will tell you is this, is there is a different reality when you're sitting with a 13-year-old who is pregnant because she was trafficked and has no idea who the dad is because she doesn't know which guy it was that got her pregnant, right? And mom told her that she can't live here if she keeps the baby. And mom is forcing her to get an abortion. That's a very different conversation than somebody might think about. So again, again, we can talk about the weight and the reality of the choice and the emotional quality of life that she's going to have from the choices that she makes at 13 years old. But at the end of the day, that 13-year-old didn't have a choice.
Right.
Because mom's like, you can't come home and live here if you're pregnant. You can either go have an abortion or you can figure out where to live. Well, is that really a choice for a 13-year-old?
No, I wouldn't say so.
Well, let's say that she makes the decision to try to keep it. So what do we do?
Yeah.
Where does she go? Who raises it? Who pays for her to continue to go to school? Who pays for the childcare? And that's the thing. So we can talk about these issues that are you know, can be black and white to a lot of us.
Right.
But then when it comes down to then what's next, like that's what I would say when it comes to the intersection of trafficking victims, especially for us that works with minors. Yeah, like we can say that's an easy answer, but the reality of it is then who's going to then walk that with that 13-year-old?
Yeah.
It's a much different conversation then. That's what I would say is we've got to have more of those conversations in order to be able to like accurately understand what it's like for that child to be sitting in that position of going, this isn't a choice. Mm-hmm. I didn't ask to be pregnant in the first place. I didn't choose to be raped. I didn't choose for this to happen. And yet if I choose to keep this baby, my family's abandoning me.
Yeah.
Like that's a really hard spot for a 13-year-old to be in.
It's incredibly difficult. And part of the reason why I asked that, I was talking to a mentor of mine, a pastor's wife, and we kind of talked about, and we're getting into a whole new can of worms, so I'll try to keep it real, real short here.
Yeah.
But essentially we were talking about how like pro-life and pro-choice. And on this podcast, we try to do a good job. At least we try. Maybe we don't succeed all the time, but we try to be fair about both sides. And I'm pro-life, 100%. Yeah. I'm all the way there. Life at conception. But I think sometimes there's always the argument of rape as a reason for abortion. And I was talking to this pastor's wife, and I said, you know, I think sometimes Christians are like, well, you know, it's life and we got to keep it. And I agree with the end conclusion. But I said, I think there's genuinely people who struggle with this question.
Yeah.
And sometimes we really skip over it and say, so my belief hasn't changed in that regard. I want that baby to live, but you're bringing up excellent questions and you're bringing up just excellent, a more in-depth and complex scenario where there's a lot of different factors going on.
And if I could just add, Jordan, I'm with you. I'm pro-life. And I remember sitting with this 13-year-old weeping.
Yeah.
Because this feels impossible. Yeah. Right. And especially without faith, like if there is no place of, and it, most anyways, I'm not even getting to that. Sorry. I'm in my head. I'm on my own tangent.
But you like, can go on a tangent. No, we're okay with that.
But I think I remember sitting there and the heaviness in that room was suffocating because she felt it was impossible. She didn't want to and felt like she had no choice. And like, there's only so much you can say. And in that moment, I can tell you for me personally, the choice was made was like, we have to love her in spite of what's happening. And she has to know that.
Absolutely.
Like so often we lead with the judgment of you've made a decision that I disagree with, and therefore now I have the right to judge you, versus like we've all made decisions, right? And the reality of it is even from a faith-based perspective, I believe, you know, I believe life is sacred, right? But at the reality of it is that I don't love that child any less an hour when she came back after the procedure than when she went out. And in fact, if anything, now things are going to be even more difficult. Because the weight of that decision, while she felt it was really not her decision, even though it was, again, it was hers. Legally, she had the right to say yes or no, right? But all of these people were influencing that there's no way you can do this. You can't come home. There's all of these things, right? She now has to carry the weight of the choice that she made for the rest of her life. And where is the support for that and the representation of the love of Christ?
Yeah, no. No, you're absolutely right. Where whether, you know, a woman has had an abortion or, you know, God forbid, a child, that they need God's love more than ever at that point where I can't imagine 13 years old. You're a kid. You're just a kid and
correct.
You're trying
to you don't have the cognitive ability brain-wise. Your brain isn't fully developed to be able to make that kind of life-altering decision, and yet here you are having to make it.
Yeah, and she's and to think that because someone, you know, chose to violate her, that she has to make a manipulative decision from other people to do this thing.
Correct.
It's an unspeakably difficult situation. I can't imagine like what you said, like that weight, like I'm almost in tears because it's just, it's too much for me. Like that's hard. That's hard because I'm so pro-life. I love children. That 13-year-old's a child to
like
me.
Such
still.
A complicated place to stand.
It is. Mm.
And I think that that's the reality. I think so often, and I'll just say this very, very bluntly, as believers, we make it so black and white. Mm-hmm. While the decision at the end of the day may be black and white, are you pro-life or are you not? Are you pro-choice or are you not? Like that can be a black and white decision, but sure, how people yeah. get there, I think is so gray oftentimes, like the example that I just shared. And that's the part that we have a hard time talking about. We can still land in the same place. I can still go. I mean, I can remember for those 48 hours leading up to that, like literally fasting and praying for mm-hmm. her and that child. Like there was such this heaviness of like what this is going to play out to be, right? And that the reality of was what it is. So what now what?
Yeah.
Right? Like I think that's the thing. It's like we have to know how to respond in the now what.
Yeah. That's a great point, because there's plenty of women out there that have gotten abortions, you know, children as well that have gotten abortions. And I think the rise of social media makes, I think sometimes turns off pro-choice people to pro-life and pro-life to pro-choice, where they kind of just do this and they're trying to get their main point across that life is life. And they're absolutely right. But as we discuss, like there are people that just genuinely struggle with what you said, that complex situation. And I think how believers respond to those complex situations is really important, because, you know, for that 13-year-old, you know, again, we're just kind of using her as an example. But God can redeem that situation.
Correct.
Like God redeems that mistake and can use that for, you know, his glory. If she had chosen to keep the baby, God would have also used mm-hmm. that for his glory. That horrific act Correct. By a horrible man can be used for God's glory. So we've seen this over and over again in the Bible. And it kind of, we do a Bible study together with some other friends, and we're studying Job. And the friends in this story really are convinced that they understand how God works.
Yeah. Can they fill me in? Because I'm still trying to figure it out. Here's what I know. God yeah. is good. That's yes. about as far as I am in my understanding.
Yeah, but they try to understand God, and at the end of the book, because we're Christians, but to clue anyone in who's not a Christian, we never find out why God right. does what he does. And that's kind of the thing in this situation, where it's not black and white. Job right. is the most grayish book to oh, ever sure. gray, be gray.
It is.
So it shows us that there are just things like, what does Job say? What does God say to Job? Try to run the universe. Mm-hmm. Try and do it. And yeah. he's like, oh, I can't
His
do
ways
that.
Are higher. And I think right. that's where you have to land. There has to, you know, and I think that, you know, for us, I will say, you know, there's personal Hannah, and then there's the leader of present age. And the reality of it is that when any of us step into that place to lead in that complicated gray area, we have to lead with love.
Yeah.
That's the bottom line. Like the decisions that are made, we may or may not agree with. How things play out, we may or may not agree with, but we must lead with love. And you know, where our authority comes because we are actually able to walk in love. And I think that that's where we have to just get any of us in any situation, you know, where we lack love, we're going to lack authority. And where we walk in authority, it's because we walk in love. And I think that just has to be the foundation for where we are.
That gray area is such a difficult one, because I remember I had a psychology professor at one of my colleges, and she was also a family counselor. And she talked about the gray area of having to pick which family she was going to let, you know, who she was going to let, you know, or recommend for a kid to be adopted by. She's like, you know, as a believer and as a Christian, it's like, I want the father, the mother, and children nucleus, but she wasn't always given that position. Sometimes she would have that. Sometimes she would have two dads. Sometimes she would have two moms that wanted to adopt. And she would have to look at the family who's your traditional nucleus and go, this is a dysfunctional family. They do not have the right qualifications to take care of this kid, you know, whatever it might be, or there were abusive tendencies, whatever it is that disqualified them from adopting a kid. And she's like, I had to make the hard decision, go against my beliefs, place that kid with, you know, two mothers to two fathers who were far more qualified to take care of this kid, even though it was against my beliefs. And it's just like that reminds me of that gray area.
Yeah.
And then the terms of pro-life and pro-choice, I think I've expressed it a couple times on the podcast that I've gotten away from them because when you're talking about pro-life, you know, from somebody who is pro-choice, the life that they're talking about is a 13-year-old girl.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where exactly. Somebody that's pro-life is concerned with exactly. the unborn infant. So I end up kind of going anti-abortion or pro-abortion. It's a little bit more specific because if you said pro-life and you're talking about death penalties about, or something else,
correct.
It can kind of get,
it's a great point,
kind of get messy there. But yeah, no, that gray area, I think you said it best, is that leading it with love in whatever situation they're given. Though given that situation with a 13-year-old, where were the legal ramifications for the parents kicking a 13-year-old out?
Well, you have to prove it, and then you have to go through the investigation of it, and then, you know, and that's mm-hmm. well beyond the timeline of the decision to be made.
Yeah. And yeah. The child is scared half to death,
right?
So right. There's that pressure that's coming in.
I don't want to disappoint my parents again. They already think all of this is my fault. You know, it's all mm-hmm. of that.
Yeah,
that plays into it. Again, just more complication. It gets more complicated the more you start to unravel it.
Yeah, because there's kind of like the basic situation, and there's the psychological issue
correct.
That's going on with that child. Right. One other odd question: adoption, was that a possibility in that scenario?
So we discussed it, and but oftentimes in various cultures, adoption is actually it's frowned upon. So that can be a harder conversation.
Okay.
Yeah. So I think it just, again, you have a lot of variables that play into that. But of course, that was brought up and mentioned.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was just curious. I was wondering if that if that was something. Are you looking up something?
Looking up a scripture because I can't ever. Remember verses and chapters, just like in history, I can't remember dates and names. Yeah. So,
oh, that's I'm unfortunate. I was actually taking a U.S. citizenship practice test the other day.
How'd that go? Because I'm pretty sure I would fail it.
I did pretty good, except for geographical locations. Horrible. Oh,
fail.
Oh yeah, but everything, the history, I did fine on, and I did pretty well.
Well, I'm glad.
Yes.
Good thing to know that you can.
Yes. Which is completely, completely off topic. And honestly, I'm kind of glad that we got on that tangent because I just think it's not something that pro-life is really willing. Pro-life, I know Connor doesn't use that term, but pro-life side is not really willing to discuss. They're like, well, that's just a small percentage of abortions. And they're right.
Yeah.
They're right. But of course, you know, when you're in a realm where that's probably common for you. And I know that that's something that even I know a lot of young ladies who are pro-choice and they have a good heart. And that's why they struggle so much and want abortion to be accessible. I know that's not what you came on this podcast to talk about, but I'm really
but
glad.
But they do intersect.
Yes, they do. They do. And what was the scripture that you found?
The scripture is just the one that I kind of gives me a little bit of comfort in these topics when we talk about just disgusting evil people that are taking advantage of children. Matthew and Mark both quoting it from Jesus, but whoever causes one of these little ones who believe in me to stumble in sin, it would be better for him to have a heavy millstone hung around his neck and be drowned in the depths of the sea. Yeah. Maybe the vengeance part of me comes out there a little bit, but that's a little bit of comfort there. Not that they're leading the kids to sin, but it's like if you were leading a kid to sin versus you are abusing them, mm-hmm. I think run in the same vein, if not worse, to do something like that. Yeah. So there's a little bit of solace I have that when it comes to Jesus's return and, you know, eternity, that there is a divine punishment that is awaiting for anybody in this life that hurts kids like that.
I agree.
Yeah. And Isaiah talks a lot about how God is going to bring justice. There will be justice one day and he will wipe every tear from every eye. But until then, our goal, I mean, as Christians, if you're not a Christian, is listening to this podcast, it'll sound a little strange to you, but we want everyone to know about Jesus and know about the gospel and have that choice. And you do it in a very dark area without forcing it upon them. So we're honestly just so appreciative that you've even come to talk to us about this really heavy topic. So what we'll do is just put all your links, all your resources down below in the description so that you guys can check her out. I'd also encourage you to, we can't give you every resource for every state, but thank goodness for Google. And if you have 20 minutes to scroll on your phone, you have 20 minutes to do research on different areas and how you can get involved and how you can be alert and how you can be educated. So I think that's just about it. If you want to follow Hannah on like any social media platforms, which one do you use the most?
So usually Instagram or Facebook.
Instagram is
where I land.
Okay, Present Age Ministries, yep. I assume is your handle. Wonderful. Yep. Okay, mm-hmm. Present Age Ministries. Hannah, thank you so much again for coming on.
Yeah, thank you for coming out.
This
good
is
to
awesome.
See you again.
Yes, yes, this has been really great. We're going to have more guests, obviously. we're pretty excited for the next ones coming on. I can't give it away because it's just too good, but we will be there. So that's really all I have. I'm not good at outros.
Well, we're done.
Oh my
that's
gosh.
It.
There we go.
Thank you, Hannah. I can't do them. I tried the intro. I tried. These it just great. Did not. It just did not work.
We'll have to get you to mix them up because I think you're stuck in the rut again where you're doing the same outro each time.
Yeah.
So there was a time in early on when Jordan's intros were all very similar.
Yeah.
And then she totally put a new spin on. She's been doing great. And now I think she's kind of getting the same.
No, I feel like I did like a fun little like obviously wooden intro. I think people will catch it. I think people.
No, that's what I'm saying. That's what I'm saying. The intros you've totally turned
you've
around.
Really good.
Okay, so the intros are good, but the outros are just.
It's the outro.
Okay.
Yeah, there's a guest coming. We're not going to tell you who it is.
There's a guest
mainly because I don't remember who it is.
It's a surprise.
Yeah. Okay, I do. Don't worry.
All right. Cool.
Awesome.
I don't know. That's it. I don't have any more. I mean, you can keep recording. Stop recording.